Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the Sunday, December 26th reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. French Guiana Telescope Rockets to New Mission by Dennis Overby and Joey Roulette. Learning in a Pandemic, We're Not Back to Normal Yet at All by Jessica Seaman. Pope Prays for Healing and Peace by Gia Pianigiani and Elisabetta Provoledo. Biden's Make Calls to Service Members by Alexandra Jaffe. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Telescope Rockets to New Mission.
At Soul Dogs Incorporated, we provide behavioral, habilitative, rehabilitative, and professional development services to individuals with intellectual, developmental, and physical disabilities and autism. Located in Westminster, but operating throughout the Front Range, the vision of Soul Dogs Incorporated is a nonprofit service agency dedicated to providing evidence of the power in the human-animal relationship in healing trauma. How can we serve you? Call us and find out. 303-484-9361. That number again is 303-484-9361. Or you can visit our webpage at www.soul-dogs-inc.org. Browse our dog training day program. Read about our leadership team. Learn about our weekend social program. See if our behavior and supported employment services are right for you. Or simply click the links to our Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or TikTok pages to see our dogs and our people at work, making life better for those we serve. Our dogs are always waiting to meet new friends. We hope you'll join us when you're ready.
Thank you for joining us for the December 27th, 2001, Monday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Dee Hyslop. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Dems I Knew Union Rights, written by Alex Burness of the Denver Post. Towering South Africa Figure Tutu Dies, written by Andrew Meldrum of the Associated Press. Federal Program Offers Assistance for Funeral Costs, written by Steve LeBlanc of the AP. Dems I Knew Union Rights. Proponents estimate the planned bill could affect 250,000 workers in the state, by Alex Burness. Colorado Democrats say they want to take a natural next step in their pro-union push with a bill to allow all public sector employees in Colorado to join unions and collectively bargain over pay, benefits, and working conditions. This follows Democrats working across two legislative sessions in 2019 and 20 to reach agreement with Governor Jared Polis on a bill allowing union leaders to engage in collective bargaining on behalf of the roughly 30,000 people who work for Colorado state government. They succeeded eventually, with Polis announcing his support just before the pandemic set in. He signed the policy into law, and last month he and the state union agreed to ratify a new contract, the first of its kind in Colorado, that included several years of cost of living raises and more paid time off, among other new benefits. The planned 2022 bill would affect all public employees, not just those working for the state. If you're a worker, no matter who your employer is, you should have some basic rights, said Senate Majority Leader Steve Fernberg, a Boulder Democrat who plans to sponsor the bill. He noted that public sector workers aren't generally afforded the same unionizing and negotiating rights available to private sector workers. The bill is still in drafting, but the plan is to introduce it in the State House of Representatives in the next session, which begins January 12th. It would be headed in that chamber by House Majority Leader Danaya Esger, a Pueblo Democrat who also negotiated the 2019 and 20 bills for the state employee union. Unlike the earlier bills, this one would not by itself force change. It doesn't create new unions or require existing ones to engage in collective bargaining. Instead, it would state that public sector workers have the ability to unionize if they choose, and it would lay out terms of bargaining for employees that make that choice. Those terms, among other bill details, are not finalized and could change before the policy is introduced. Proponents estimate more than 250,000 workers stand to be affected by the policy, including those who work in public education, first responders, and anyone else employed in the public sector in Colorado outside of state government. The bill has assured pushback from public sector leaders. The state absolutely has a role in determining how to dictate employment matters for its own employees, but the state shouldn't be involved in determining employment matters at other levels of government, said Kevin Bomber, executive director of the Colorado Municipal League, which represents and lobbies for towns and cities. He suggests lawmakers could be in violation of the state constitution by wading into local control matters over which it doesn't have jurisdiction. With all due respect to the proponents and sponsors, local control and home rule authority is derived by citizens through their votes and through their daily elected officials, Bomber said. Under current law, those local officials do not need to recognize employee efforts to unionize. A group of workers can say they're forming a union, but that union would be largely ineffective without recognition from its town, city, or county leaders and without the ability to bargain over contract terms. The majority of the time when we go into these conversations around the collective bargaining and negotiations, it's just workers simply wanting to have a voice when it comes to safety, workflow, how they can provide ideas and be heard. It's not always just salary and benefits, Esger said. Added Peter Della Vecchia, a Denver paramedic and member of the Denver Health Workers United Union, it's not so much that we're trying to line our own pockets. Working conditions right now are just really, really difficult. We want fair market compensation, but we want benefits, a good work-life balance. The left-leaning national think tank Economic Policy Institute has estimated that workers covered by collective bargaining contracts can make about 13% more money on average than non-unionized people doing comparable work, and that they are 28% more likely to have employee-provided health insurance. They're also more likely to have employer-provided pensions and more paid time off, research shows. Michelle Murphy, executive director of the Colorado Rural Schools Alliance, echoed Bomber's concerns and added that her organization, which represents 146 rural districts, doesn't think it's necessary to impose a state mandate in order for workers to feel empowered to seek better pay and benefits. It would be our position that that decision properly resides within the jurisdiction of local school boards, she said, adding that she can recall only one instance in the past decade in which rural education workers attempted to unionize and were rebuffed. We don't really know in K through 12 what problem we're trying to solve here. Colorado AFL-CIO President Josette Jaramillo countered that the problem in K through 12 is that public sector workers do not have guaranteed rights to advocate for themselves and their colleagues. That kind of guarantee from the state would be much different from the present situation in which union organizers in the public sector must ask permission to be recognized, she said. So I think this bill is something that's really needed for public employees to have that seat at the table, she said. The AFL-CIO's Jaramillo called the legislative proposal well-timed. We are living in this really crazy time when it is the employee's marketplace. COVID really kicked that off, where folks have the opportunity and ability to be a little more choosy about where they want to work, she said. We have lots of vacancies. Hiring is tough right now. I think that very much lends to the moment of not accepting the status quo. I think workers are seeing their value. Neither opponents nor proponents of the proposal have estimates for how many workers would form unions if a bill becomes law. Jaramillo said labor leaders would likely target work in places where they find a real appetite for organizing instead of casting a wider net that would be like farting in the wind. Any bill would need the governor's okay to become law. Polis did come around on the 2020 bill, and the current proposal's sponsors say that with their policy still in drafting, it's too soon to know whether they'll have the governor's backing. It is generally true, however, that a bill with both majority leaders signed onto it, it will have a strong chance of succeeding. Towering South Africa fixtures, Tutu dies. Nobel Peace Prize winner worked tirelessly to bring down apartheid, by Andrew Meldrum of the Associated Press. Desmond Tutu, South Africa's Nobel Peace Prize-winning icon, an uncompromising foe of apartheid, and a modern-day activist for racial justice and LGBT rights, died Sunday at 90. South Africans, world leaders, and people around the globe mourned the death of the man viewed as the country's moral conscience. Tutu worked passionately, tirelessly, and nonviolently to tear down apartheid, South Africa's brutal decades-long regime of oppression against its black majority that only ended in 1994. The buoyant, blunt-spoken clergyman used his pulpit as the first black bishop of Johannesburg and later as the Anglican Archbishop of Cape Town, as well as frequent public demonstrations to galvanize public opinion against racial inequity, both at home and globally. Nicknamed the Arch, the diminutive Tutu became a towering figure in the nation's history, comparable to fellow Nobel laureate Nelson Mandela, a prisoner during white rule who became South Africa's first black president. Tutu and Mandela shared a commitment to building a better, more equal South Africa. Upon becoming president in 1994, Mandela appointed Tutu to be chairman of the country's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which uncovered the abuses of apartheid. Tutu's death on Sunday is another chapter of bereavement in our nation's farewell to a generation of outstanding South Africans who have bequeathed us a liberated South Africa, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said. From the pavements of resistance in South Africa to the pulpits of the world's great cathedrals and places of worship and the prestigious setting of the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony, the Arch distinguished himself as a non-sectarian, inclusive champion of universal human rights, he said. Tutu died peacefully at the Oasis Frail Care Center in Cape Town, the Archbishop Desmond Tutu Trust said. He had been hospitalized several times since 2015 after being diagnosed with prostate cancer in 1997. He turned his own misfortune into a teaching opportunity to raise awareness and reduce the suffering of others, said the Tutu Trust. He wanted the world to know that he had prostate cancer and that the sooner it is detected, the better the chance of managing it. In recent years, he and his wife, Leah, lived in a retirement community outside Cape Town. Former U.S. President Barack Obama hailed Tutu as a moral compass for me and so many others, a universal spirit. Archbishop Tutu was grounded in the struggle for liberation and justice in his own country, but also concerned with injustice everywhere. He never lost his impish sense of humor and willingness to find humanity in his adversaries. Tutu's life was entirely dedicated to serving his brothers and sisters for the greater common good. He was a true humanitarian, said the Dalai Lama, Tibet's exiled spiritual leader and Tutu's friend. His legacy is moral strength, moral courage, and clarity, Anglican Archbishop of Cape Town Thabo Makgobo said in a video statement. He felt with the people. In public and alone, he cried because he felt people's pain, and he laughed. No, not just laughed. He cackled with delight when he shared their joy. A 7-day mourning period is planned in Cape Town before Tutu's burial, including a 2-day lying in state, an ecumenical service, and an Anglican Requiem Mass at St. George's Cathedral in Cape Town. The Southern City's landmark, Table Mountain, will be lit up in purple, the color of the robes Tutu wore as Archbishop. Throughout the 1980s, when South Africa was gripped by anti-apartheid violence and a state of emergency gave police and the military sweeping powers, Tutu was one of the most prominent black leaders able to speak out against abuses. A lively wit lightened Tutu's hard-hitting messages and warmed otherwise grim protests, funerals, and marches. Plucky and tenacious, he was a formidable force with a canny talent for quoting apt scriptures to harness support for change. The Nobel Peace Prize in 1984 highlighted his stature as one of the world's most effective champions for human rights, a responsibility he took seriously for the rest of his life. With the end of apartheid and South Africa's first democratic elections in 1994, Tutu celebrated the country's multiracial society, calling it a rainbow nation, a phrase that captured the heady optimism of the moment. In 1990, after 27 years in prison, Mandela spent his first night of freedom at Tutu's residence in Cape Town. Later, Mandela called Tutu the People's Archbishop. Tutu also campaigned internationally for human rights, especially LGBTQ rights and same-sex marriage. "I would not worship a god who is homophobic," he said in 2013, launching a campaign for LGBTQ rights in Cape Town. "I would refuse to go to a homophobic heaven. No, I would say, sorry, I would much rather go to the other place." Tutu said he was as passionate about this campaign as I ever was about apartheid. "For me, it is at the same level." He was one of the most prominent religious leaders to advocate LGBTQ rights, a stance that put him at odds with many in South Africa and across the continent, as well as within the Anglican Church. South Africa, Tutu said, was a rainbow nation of promise for racial reconciliation and equality, even though he grew disillusioned with the African National Congress, the anti-apartheid movement that became the ruling party after the 1994 election. His outspoken remarks, long after apartheid, sometimes angered partisans who accused him of being biased or out of touch. Tutu was particularly incensed by the South African government's refusal to grant a visa to the Dalai Lama, preventing the Tibetan spiritual leader from attending Tutu's 80th birthday, as well as a planned gathering of Nobel laureates in Cape Town. The government rejected Tutu's accusations that it was bowing to pressure from China, a major trading partner. Early in 2016, Tutu defended the reconciliation policy that ended white minority rule and increasing frustrations among some black South Africans who felt they had not seen the expected economic opportunities since apartheid ended. Tutu had chaired the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that investigated atrocities under apartheid and granted amnesty to some perpetrators, but some people believed that more former white officials should have been prosecuted. Desmond Mapilo Tutu was born October 7, 1931, in Klerksdorp, west of Johannesburg, and became a teacher before entering St. Peter's Theological College in Rostenville in 1958. He was ordained in 1961 and 6 years later became chaplain at the University of Fort Hare. He then moved to the tiny southern African kingdom of Lesotho and to Britain, returning home in 1975. He became Bishop of Lesotho, chairman of the South African Council of Churches, and in 1985, the first black Anglican bishop of Johannesburg. In 1986, Tutu was named the first black archbishop of Cape Town. He ordained women priests and promoted gay priests. Tutu was arrested in 1980 for joining a protest and later had his passport confiscated for the first time. He got it back for trips to the United States and Europe, where he spoke with the UN Secretary General, the Pope, and other church leaders. Tutu called for international sanctions against South Africa and talks to end apartheid. Tutu often conducted funeral services after the massacres that marked the negotiating period of 1990 to 1994. He railed against black-on-black political violence, asking crowds, "Why are we doing this to ourselves?" In one powerful moment, Tutu diffused the rage of thousands of mourners in a township soccer stadium after the Boipatong massacre of 42 people in 1992. Leading the crowd in chants proclaiming their love of God and themselves. As head of the Truth Commission, Tutu and his panel listened to harrowing testimony about torture, killings, and other atrocities during apartheid. At some hearings, Tutu wept openly. "Without forgiveness, there is no future," he said at the time. The Commission's 1998 report lay most of the blame on the forces of apartheid, but also found the African National Congress guilty of human rights violations. The ANC sued to block the document's release, earning a rebuke from Tutu. "I didn't struggle in order to remove one set of those who thought they were tin gods to replace them with others who are tempted to think they are," Tutu said. In July 2015, Tutu renewed the 1955 wedding vows with wife Leia, surrounded by their four children. Tutu is survived by his wife of 66 years and their children. Asked once how he wanted to be remembered, he told the Associated Press, "He loved, he laughed, he cried. He was forgiven. He forgave. Greatly privileged." Federal program offers assistance for funeral costs by Steve LeBlanc of the AP. When Wanda Olson's son-in-law died in March after contracting COVID-19, she and her daughter had to grapple with more than just their sudden grief. They had to come up with money for a cremation. Even without a funeral, the bill came to nearly $2,000, a hefty sum that Olson initially covered. She and her daughter then learned of a federal program that reimburses families up to $9,000 for funeral costs for loved ones who died of COVID-19. Olson's daughter submitted an application to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, received a deposit by June, and was able to reimburse her mother the $1,974. "Had this not been available, we would have been paying the money ourselves," said Olson, 80, of Villa Rica, Florida. "There wasn't any red tape. This was a very easy, well-handled process." As of December 6th, about 226,000 people had shared in the nearly $1.5 billion that FEMA has spent on funeral costs that occurred after January 20th, 2020, the date of the first confirmed case of COVID-19 in the U.S. With the nation's coronavirus death toll topping 800,000, it's clear that many families who are eligible for reimbursement have yet to take advantage of the funeral benefit. Her son-in-law was traveling a lot, working on air conditioning systems in theaters, restaurants, and businesses when he began feeling ill, Olson said. After a few days at home, he went to the hospital and was put on a ventilator. He died several weeks later. "He could never overcome it," she said. "To be eligible for reimbursement, death certificates for those who died after May 16, 2020 must indicate that the death was attributed to COVID-19. For deaths that occurred in the early months of the pandemic, from January 20th to May 16, 2020, death certificates must be accompanied with a signed statement from a medical examiner, coroner, or the certifying official listed on the certificate indicating that COVID-19 was the cause or a contributing cause of death. The percentage of individuals who have been reimbursed varies dramatically from state to state, from nearly 40% in North Carolina and Maryland to fewer than 15% in Idaho and Oregon, according to state-by-state data compiled by FEMA. While the reimbursement must go directly to individuals, some funeral directors have taken on the task of informing grieving families of the benefit. After the benefit was first announced, David Shipper, owner of the Sunset Funeral Home, Creation Center, and Cemetery in Evansville, Indiana, took out ads to let people know that help was available if they qualified. $9,000, that's a lot of money. We want to find a way to tell people about it, he said. We stopped advertising some time ago, but when we have a new family with a death from COVID, we tell them about the program. Workers at the home will sit down with families, gather the needed paperwork, contact FEMA on the phone, and help walk them through the process if they ask, he said. Many families may simply be unaware of the benefit, but others may opt against seeking the cash out of reluctance to revisit the pain of the death, Shipper said. He said the better time to seek the help is when planning the funeral. They're much more likely to take advantage right then than if they've already spent the money and don't want to open it up again, Shipper said. The largest states account for some of the biggest shares of the FEMA reimbursement money. The program has paid out more than 21,000 reimbursements in California and Texas, which have both reported more than 74,000 COVID-19 deaths. Residents applied for more than $141 million in each state. The fewest number of reimbursements have occurred in Vermont, where 123 people were awarded a total of about $704,000. Expenses covered under the FEMA program include funeral services, cremation, and internment, as well as the costs for caskets or urns, burial plots or cremation niches, markers or headstones, transportation or transfer of remains, clergy or officiant services, and the use of funeral home equipment or staff. The program has been funded using federal stimulus funds, and money remains available. No online applications are allowed. After all required documents are received and verified, it typically takes fewer than 30 days to determine if an individual is eligible, according to FEMA. Once eligibility is confirmed, applicants who request direct deposit may receive the money in a matter of days. It may take longer for applicants to request a check. The reimbursement is one way of helping ease the emotional and financial burden that the pandemic has wreaked on communities across the country, according to Ellen Wynn McBrayer, president of Jones Wynn Funeral Homes and Crematory in Villarica, Georgia. She recalled one woman who lost her mother, husband, and one of her children to the disease in the span of 6 months. One of the workers at the funeral home also succumbed to the virus. To have to help a grieving family is hard on a normal day, but to see so many deaths, she said, COVID has just broken a lot of hearts and taken a lot of lives. Former paramedic asks judge to dismiss charges, by Elise Schmelzer. One of the former Aurora paramedics indicted on manslaughter charges in connection with Elijah McClain's death is asking a judge to dismiss the case against him, arguing there is not enough evidence to warrant the charges. Lawyers for former Aurora Fire Rescue paramedic Peter Chuchunik filed a motion December 16th requesting that Adams County District Court Judge Priscilla Lowe review the evidence in the grand jury documents and find that there is not enough probable cause to support the 11 charges against the paramedic. The charges include manslaughter, negligent homicide, and assault. The evidence contained in the grand jury record is devoid of any evidence to establish probable cause to believe that Mr. Chuchunik knew that the principal here, paramedic Jeremy Cooper, was about to engage in conduct in determining the need for and the amount of ketamine needed. That was a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would exercise, or that paramedic Cooper was administering ketamine for any purpose other than a lawful medical or therapeutic purpose, the motion states. A grand jury on September 1st indicted paramedics Chuchunik and Cooper and three Aurora police officers on 32 total charges in connection with the 2019 death of Elijah McClain. The three officers, Randy Redema, Jason Rosenblatt, and Nathan Woodyard, detained at McClain on August 24, 2019, after receiving a call about a suspicious person. They forced him to the ground and used a chokehold designed to block blood flow to the brain before paramedics arrived and Cooper injected him with ketamine, an anesthetic. McClain suffered cardiac arrest on the way to the hospital and never woke up. He was declared brain dead August 27, 2019. The grand jury indictment followed a criminal investigation by the Colorado Attorney General's office, sparked by massive racial justice protests in the summer of 2020. Former 17th Judicial District Attorney Dave Young previously declined to prosecute those involved in McLean's death. Chechenik's attorneys wrote in their motion that the paramedic did not administer any medication to McLean and that he was not responsible for medical decisions made on scene. The grand jury indictment states that Chechenik was in charge of the Aurora Fire Rescue crew and scene safety, while Cooper was the medic responsible for medical decisions about McLean. Chechenik ordered the ketamine from a nearby ambulance, and Cooper injected McLean with a too large dose of the sedative, according to the indictment. Chechenik's attorneys also argued in their motion for dismissal that paramedic Chechenik's conduct and paramedic Cooper's administration of ketamine in this instance was for a medical purpose and pursuant to the training provided and the protocols established by the Aurora Fire Rescue. Grand juries must find there is probable cause to believe someone committed a crime to indict them. Probable cause is proved if there is a reasonable basis for believing that a crime may have been committed, a far less stringent standard of proof than the beyond a reasonable doubt standard that is needed for a trial jury to convict someone. Neither the judge nor prosecutors with the Colorado Attorney General's office have filed a response to the motion. A spokesman for the Attorney General's office declined to comment on the motion Thursday. Chechenik is scheduled for arraignment on January 7th. All five defendants are free on bond while the cases proceed. And from the series Faces of the Front Range, I am going to make myself a game. Popango, created by Denver Man, is cornhole meets skee-ball meets beer pong by Aldous Faldi. The long weeks under pandemic quarantine last year frustrated Denver resident Errol Anderson, who missed hanging out with his friends and playing basketball on the weekends. When they finally gathered after months apart, Anderson tried to come up with a safe outdoor activity, one that allowed for social distancing and could keep everyone interested. He purchased a cornhole game for $160 and brought it along. His friends played only two rounds before they moved on. A disappointed Anderson tried to exchange the game, but couldn't find any appealing alternatives. "I woke up the next day and decided, I'm going to make myself a game," he said. He wanted one that would engage not only the players, but those watching, where come-from-behind victories replaced predictability. He grabbed a notebook and sketched and resketched what the game would look like, going through 10 different designs. He borrowed the baseboard used in cornhole, bought multicolored cups and foam golf balls, and started experimenting with different rules and scoring systems. Instead of players trying to land beanbags in one big hole on a board, his game has 9 holes holding cups of different colors, each representing different point values, including one called the equalizer that subtracts points. Players bounce or throw 5 foam golf balls from 15 feet away, trying to score and reach an agreed-upon point total. If they overshoot the total, the equalizer cup allows them to deduct points. It is cornhole meets skee-ball meets beer pong, a game where random bounces can allow novices to upstage favorites. Anderson named his game Popango, a made-up word that bounces off the tongue as readily as the foam balls bounce around the board. "It means nothing," Anderson grins when pressed for the deeper meaning of the word, which is shouted when a player hits the winning score, like in bingo. Anderson, however, was deliberate in the colors he chose. The game's black, yellow, and green represent a nod to the Jamaican flag, reflective of the island nation's people, sunshine, and lush vegetation, said the Montego Bay native, who immigrated to Denver 15 years ago when he was 32. The red is a nod to African roots, and the blue represents the clear water and skies of the Caribbean. "It is nothing like cornhole. It is actually exciting," said Anderson while demonstrating how to play. Anderson's background is in finance, a career path he chose over the one his mother had planned for him, law. He has his hand in several ventures, but never did he envision himself developing a game until the pandemic pushed him, like many people, down unplanned paths. New business formations in Colorado were flat in 2019 compared to 2018, and over the prior 5 years were growing at an average annual rate of 4%, according to statistics from the Colorado Secretary of State. In 2020, new business starts shot up 22% from 2019, pushing the five-year average annual growth rate to 8.2%, an unexpected outcome of the worst disease outbreak the world has faced in a century. And while business starts are down slightly in Colorado this year versus 2020, they remain well ahead of pre-pandemic levels as more entrepreneurs like Anderson, who is self-funding his venture, step forward. As he was developing the game, Anderson chose a Denver design-build firm that could handle smaller volumes over Chinese manufacturers. Capacity has since gone from 100 boards a day to 500 a day, although orders for the game, which is available online for $139.99, are nowhere near that level. Anderson is hustling hard to get people to play the game and build its recognition, making appearances on local and national television and in magazine articles. The odds are long, but Anderson has a long-term plan. Jamaica has given the world more than its share of great athletes and musicians, Anderson said, but to his knowledge, no Jamaican has developed a commercially successful game. He wants to be the first, and he wants his success to create jobs in his adopted home. I feel like I am adding to the Jamaican culture, and in that I have a lot of pride, he said. Another way Anderson is giving back to his home country is by sponsoring the Jamaican bobsled team in the 2022 Olympic Winter Games in Beijing. His goal is to raise $100,000 through donations and directing a portion of game and T-shirt sales to the team, whose appearance in the 1988 Olympics in Calgary was highlighted in the movie Cool Runnings. That an underfunded team from a tropical country would even try to compete in a signature winter sport is a classic underdog story. The road ahead for Anderson, like the Jamaican bobsled team, might be steep and long as he tries to create the next big thing, but the motto he ascribes to Papango applies to his situation. Man who killed two at bar found guilty of murder. A man who shot and killed two people outside a Westminster bar in March was convicted Thursday of first-degree murder. The jury returned its verdict against Stephen Munoz, 40, after a 9-day trial in Adams County. The 17th Judicial District Attorney's Office said that Munoz was at Sports Watch Bar and Grill along Lowell Boulevard in Westminster with some family and friends that night in March, and that Munoz's group at some point during the evening got into a fight with others at the bar. Prosecutors said Munoz punched one person and that the confrontation died down before flaring back up again, with Munoz's fatally shooting two, 33-year-old Keith Ames Arms and Jessica Ibarra, 31. The jury returned guilty verdicts against Munoz in four counts. He is set to be sentenced January 5th. Another man involved in the case, Robert Manzanares, was already tried and convicted for helping Munoz flee the scene by car after the March shooting. Man who shot ex-girlfriend's boyfriend gets life sentence. A man who fatally shot his former girlfriend's new boyfriend has been sentenced to life in prison. Joseph McGoffin shot and killed 16-year-old Ryan Robertson in May 2019 after he learned his ex-girlfriend was dating him, according to Arapahoe County court records, KUSA-TV reported. McGoffin broke into his former girlfriend's house and told her, "If I ever see Robertson again, I will kill you and him." Police said McGoffin and Robertson encountered each other near Wagon Trail Park in Aurora. McGoffin, Robertson, and two friends of Robertson exchanged words when McGoffin pulled out a gun and began shooting at Robertson. Records show that McGoffin shot at Robertson 6 to 7 times. Robertson was shot twice and died from his injuries. The Aurora Police Department said McGoffin was firing in the direction of Independence Elementary School, where numerous adults and children were in the line of fire. No one else was injured. Now to sports. That's a wrap. Broncos run game sputters as Raiders dominate trenches. Playoff hopes in dire shape after fourth straight loss to Vegas, by Ryan O'Halloran. As they trudged off the Allegiant Stadium turf Sunday after a 17-13 loss to the Las Vegas Raiders, the Broncos should have been equal parts depressed and enraged. Just 8 days after having full control of their playoff hopes, the Broncos flew home closer to the 4-win New York Jets and Houston Texans in the AFC standings than the 11-win Kansas City Chiefs. Ouch. Another year of watching the playoffs is upcoming. The Broncos, 7-8, are still and also ran. The Broncos can't score. Three offensive touchdowns in their last three losses. They can't stop the run. Las Vegas chewed them up for 160 yards. And they can't beat the Raiders. Four consecutive losses. Time to play out the final two games at the Chargers and home to Kansas City and wonder how General Manager George Patton will start his 2022 project. New coach, new assistants, new core players, all of the above. Everything should be on the table. The players are disappointed like we all are, said Coach Vic Fangio, whose team is 4-8 since a 3-0 start. But these guys are competitors. They're fighters, and we're going to do everything we can to get that eighth win. It won't matter now, though. Through Sunday's games, the Broncos were 13th in the AFC and are 1-7 against teams ahead of them. Turning to quarterback Drew Lock because of Teddy Bridgewater's concussion, the Broncos figured to struggle on offense. But not this bad, right? Not counting last year's quarterbackless debacle against New Orleans, it was arguably the team's worst offensive performance since a 30-0 loss at Philadelphia 29 years ago. The Broncos' 18 rushing yards were tied for the third fewest in franchise history. Their 8 first yards were their fewest in a game in which they had a true quarterback playing since that Eagles game. Their 158 yards of offense were their second fewest since that Eagles game. And their 40 offensive plays were tied with that Eagles game for the second fewest in franchise history. Think about that. In this past half decade of offensive ineptitude, the Broncos always did things better than the eyesore of a product they presented against Las Vegas. And then there is the defense, which, as outside linebacker Bradley Chubb said, didn't hold up our end of the bargain aside from 3 takeaways that led to 10 points. Las Vegas held possession for 36 minutes, 37 seconds, and ran 27 more plays than the Broncos. Still, the Broncos stormed into halftime with a 13-7 lead thanks to 10 points in a span of 17 seconds. Locke, making his first start since last year's finale against the Raiders, and the offense started punt, punt, field goal, and punt. Las Vegas led 7-0 on Derek Carr's 10-yard touchdown pass to receiver Hunter Renfrow. Brandon McManus's 49-yard field goal started a string of 13 consecutive Broncos points. Josh Jacobs, before he ran over the Broncos, handed them a gift when he fumbled a pass from Carr that was recovered by nose tackle Mike Purcell at the Raiders' 41. The Broncos could only get McManus's 55-yard field goal after wasting an 8-yard catch by receiver Cortland Sutton to start the drive. On the next play from scrimmage, Carr was looking for Jacobs on a screen to the left when Chubb read the play perfectly, deflected the pass with his right hand, and collected his first NFL interception. The 21-yard return to the Raiders 1 set up Javonte Williams's touchdown 15 seconds before halftime. Suddenly, the Broncos had the lead and momentum. The plan was to rely on Fangio's defense to keep the Raiders in check and escape with a victory. Not quite. Enter Jacobs. To open the third quarter, he sliced and diced the Broncos for carries of 8, 7, 3, 8, 4, and 8 yards to set up Peyton Barber's 5-yard touchdown. It was Cleveland and Philadelphia all over again for the Broncos. They knew the Raiders were going to run it, and it didn't make a darn bit of difference. We just needed to play it better, and I just needed to call it better, Fangio said. Any time something like that happens, it is coaches and players together. We were trying most everything we had. They were doing a good job of blocking, and Jacobs was obviously doing a good job of running. Jacobs' 129 yards were the second most by a Broncos opposing player this year. The Raiders extended the lead to 4 with 7:35 remaining, and the Broncos' last gasp reached the Las Vegas 44. Locke was sacked on third down, and Fangio opted to punt it on 4th and 16 from midfield. The Broncos never got the ball back. Bad offense, bad defense, just bad all around. The heat on Fangio will turn into an inferno this week, and understandably so. Can one win in the final 2 weeks earn him a fourth year? Only Patton knows. I've never been to the playoffs, so I felt like this was the most complete team to make that run, defensive end Shelby Harris said. We just keep falling short. And from Mike Kisla, they can quit pretending to be somebody now. Pressure's on Patton to fix this mess. In a city built on broken dreams where every fool thinks his lousy luck is about to change, the Broncos finally crapped out and boarded a plane home after a 17-13 loss to Las Vegas ripped their ticket to the NFL playoffs to shreds. At the end of the day, we knew this was a win-or-go-home type of situation, and we didn't do enough, Broncos defensive end Shelby Harris said Sunday. So let's end the delusional thinking, this crazy, naive notion that all that's standing between the Broncos and playoff contention is incompetence on the sideline. While Pat Shurmur isn't qualified to coordinate a kid's birthday party, much less a complex NFL offense, and Vic Fangio is a good soul, not emotionally wired to be a head coach, they are far from the biggest problems with this team. Broncos general manager George Patton has to find better players starting at quarterback, or he won't last long in employment of the team's next owner. The honeymoon's over, George. While cornerback Pat Surtain, the second, and running back Javonte Williams were fine draft choices, they don't mean diddly unless Patton can coax Russell Wilson out of Seattle or convince Green Bay to move Aaron Rodgers from the frozen tundra to the Rocky Mountains. In 3 seasons on the job, Fangio's record against the Raiders and Chiefs, the 2 teams most despised by the denizens of Broncos country, is 1-10. That alone is reason enough to get him fired, because if Patton tries to sell the return of Uncle Vic to frustrated masses in 2022, there will be bile and blood. So let's stop living on the prayer that there are so many meh teams in the NFL that enough of them will fall down at Denver's feet and allow the Broncos to step over that stinking heap of mediocrity and slip into the playoffs through the back door. After an interception by linebacker Bradley Chubb allowed the Broncos to take a 13-7 lead at halftime, they let the opportunity slip through their hands, most notably when tight end Albert Okwuegbunam dropped a pass deep in Las Vegas' territory late in the fourth quarter. Uncharacteristic of him, and it hurts me for him, quarterback Drew Locke said, but I know it will hurt him tremendously for the next couple days. Locke proved nothing in the game except he can do a bad imitation of Teddy Bridgewater and lead drives that can't get out of neutral, much less find a high gear. I don't view it as the season over or anything like that, Fangio said. Well, I hate to break it to Uncle Vic, but the analysts over at the website 538 now give the Broncos less than a 1 in 1,000 chance to make the playoffs. Pigs have a better chance of flying. When I listen to Uncle Vic talk, I hear the voice of Wade Phillips. Phillips is a Hall of Fame defensive coordinator. Fangio is a Hall of Fame defensive coordinator. But just as Phillips was the wrong head coach for the Broncos in 1994, Fangio is the wrong man to head the team back to playoff relevancy now. I'm not ashamed to admit being fond of Uncle Vic. He's good people with a saucy sense of humor few know. I wish the Broncos could ask him to step aside from the top job and retain him as defensive coordinator, but that's not how these things work. But the Broncos lost to the hated Raiders because former first-round pick Jerry Jeudy has trouble running routes to the first-down stick and would have a hard time finding the end zone with Siri giving him turn-by-turn directions. After 25 games as a pro, Jeudy has caught 3 touchdown passes. He's not a draft bust, but he certainly ain't Justin Jefferson selected by Minnesota 7 picks after Jeudy went off the board at number 15 overall in 2020. For the second time in as many games, with money and playoff dreams on the line, Brandon McManus whiffed on a field goal from about beyond 50 yards. Yes, the 55-yarder he missed against the Raiders was no chip shot, but McManus isn't paid $4.2 million per season to grouse at Denver coaches for not getting him off the sideline quick enough after failing to do his job. If playoff tickets are punched in the trenches, then both the Denver offensive and defensive lines need an upgrade. Running backs Melvin Gordon and Williams combined for a paltry 8 yards on 14 carries, and the Broncos surrendered the lead on the opening drive of the second half when Vegas pounded the rock on a 9-play, 75-yard touchdown drive capped with a 5-yard run by Peyton Barber. Harris summarized this lost season in 2 sad notes. "It's trash," he said. "In the NFL, your identity is defined by your record, not by the sweet lies you tell yourself in the mirror. And the Broncos appear doomed to finish last in the AFC West for the second straight year. Firing Fangio might be the place to start, but fixing this mess is on Patton. What this team needs more than a scapegoat is bona fide players. I'm guessing whoever pays $3.5 billion to own the Broncos will expect more bang for their buck than the woulda, coulda, shoulda excuses these players now offer." Jokic and Reed seal victory over Clippers on the road by Mike Singer. Nikola Jokic checked into the fourth quarter Sunday night earlier than he almost ever does. The Nuggets needed every second of their MVP savior. Jokic hoisted his team on his broad shoulders and survived with a gripping 103-100 road win against the Clippers. The Nuggets snapped their 2-game losing streak and improved to 16-16 on the season, with a 2-game set against the Warriors beginning on Tuesday. Jokic was sublime. He played the entire 10 minutes, 34 seconds of the fourth quarter, finishing with 26 points, 22 rebounds, 8 assists, 3 blocks, and 2 steals. It was his second consecutive 2020 game. Devon Reed, on his second 10-day contract with the Nuggets, had 15 points and 3 three-pointers off the bench. His defense on the final sequence, contesting a three-pointer from Brandon Boston on the wing, sealed the game. The Nuggets held a 17-point lead with 7:45 left in the third quarter and appeared well on their way to a convincing road win. Monte Morris found a rhythm with his jumper, and Jokic continued to impose himself inside. Then the same bad habits, the turnovers, the shot selection, cropped up once again. The Clippers reeled off a 26-5 run to close the third quarter. On many occasions, the mistakes were self-inflicted, with little ball movement on offense and no resistance on defense. The Clippers, brewing with momentum, carried an 83-79 lead into the fourth. Not that the Nuggets ever rely on excuses, but Aaron Gordon's absence due to a hamstring injury only dug deeper into their depth. Nuggets coach Michael Malone said he checked his phone prior to Sunday's game and caught a quick glimpse of the rising COVID cases throughout the league. "It's almost becoming a sense of normalcy with what we're dealing with, which is scary," he said. "This is getting really crazy, and it's not going away." The Nuggets were all still smarting a few days later after seeing their 17-point fourth-quarter lead dissolve against Charlotte last Thursday. "We had one assist in the fourth quarter," Malone said. "The ball stopped moving. We became a dribble-happy team, an isolation team, a one-on-one team. That's not who we are. That affected our defense. It was just a collapse, obviously, and the blame should really be put on my shoulders as the head coach." To his delight, the Nuggets played unselfish, organic basketball in the first half versus the Clippers. Their 64-55 halftime lead was a product of balanced offense. 3 players reached double figures, and a superlative effort from Denver's second unit. Jokic paced the starters with 12 points, 7 rebounds, and 6 assists over the first two quarters, but the Nuggets' reserves expanded the lead to 12 at one point. Led by 13 points from Reed, the Nuggets' bench poured in 30 points in the first half. If it wasn't Reed's shooting, then it was Bones Highland or Facu Campazzo causing havoc in the lane. All told, the Nuggets served up 18 assists in the first half, discombobulating the Clippers with their speed and pace. And Avs say they have had 11 players who tested positive since December 16th by Mike Chambers. The Avalanche returned from its COVID shutdown on Sunday with 15 skaters and goalie Darcy Kemper practicing at Ball Arena before the entire coaching staff. The team announced it has had 11 players test positive for COVID since December 16th. Forwards Mikko Rantanen, Nazem Kadri, Logan O'Connor, and defenseman Curtis McDermott and goalie Pavel Francouz are currently on the protocol list. Kemper came off the list along with defenseman Cale Makar and Devon Taves. All three missed the Avs' previous game on December 16th at Nashville. Also, Colorado left wing and team captain Gabe Landeskog has been fully cleared to return to the lineup after missing 3 games with a lower body injury. That's a big positive for us, especially with some of the new guys that are on the protocol list, Colorado coach Jared Bednar said. The Avs' next scheduled game is Wednesday against the visiting Dallas Stars, who added 5 players to their COVID protocol list on Sunday. The teams are also scheduled to play on Friday in Dallas. Bednar said he expects both games will take place as planned. We had a bunch of guys come off protocol the last 3 days, including 3 today, he said. I'm sure now at this point the whole league is going through this, and in a way we're probably a little bit fortunate that we've had so many guys at once and we were able to pause for a little bit over Christmas. Hopefully we can come out of the next week or so healthy and get our lineup back together. Seems like the whole season since we haven't had it. McDermott is scheduled to rejoin the team Monday and Kadri on Tuesday. O'Connor could possibly return Thursday and Rantanen on Friday, the team said. Francouz isn't scheduled back until January 5th. Bednar said a goalie, presumably rookie Justus Annanen, will be recalled from the Colorado Eagles and practice at Ball Arena on Monday when the Avs were originally scheduled to play at the Vegas Golden Knights. At least 2 forwards will also be recalled, Bednar said. For now, the Avs will have to make up 5 postponed games. During the Avalanche's shutdown, the NHL announced it will not send players to the Winter Olympics in February, leaving a 3-week gap for teams to find dates for makeup games. Bednar said the news was a relief for coaches and management. My take on it is, if the players want to go, I want them to be able to go, if they're really excited about it. My take on it now with everything going on is the season is a priority, even for the players, and it seems like this COVID wave is going to go through the league, he said. Hopefully we can find the dates in that break and play and sort of keep the season going and maybe get a few days of downtime during that break if everything goes smoothly from here on. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Dee Hyslop.